Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 178, I continue my conversation with Anthony Grimani about room acoustics, this time focusing on seating and speaker placement. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded October 14th, 2013, episode 178, Acoustics 102. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use. It doesn't require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit htg.ting.com. That's htg.ting.com. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and director of content at avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Anthony Grimani, who's returning for part two of our excellent discussion on room acoustics and what to do to make your room not the worst component in your system. Hey, Anthony, welcome back.
Hi, Scott. Hi, geeks. How are you all?
I'm doing great, and I'm sure all the geeks out there in geekdom are doing fine, too. There are quite a few people in the chat room, as always, and those folks, as well as anyone watching live at live.twit.tv, can post questions for Anthony as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Anthony, last week we talked quite a bit about room acoustics and acoustic treatments, how to place absorbers and diffusers and bass traps around the room so that the sound of the room and the sound of the sound system within the room would be greatly improved. What we didn't get to, and what I'm so glad you came back to talk about this week, is speaker placement, subwoofer placement, and seating placement. Because those also have a great impact on your experience of the audio portion of any home theater presentation.
That's correct, Scott. The first rule, actually, of seating placement or speaker placements is called Murphy's First Law of Acoustics, which is wherever you want to put your seats is where the sound's going to be the worst in the room. So,
of course.
So you have to wait until Murphy's busy doing something else to somebody else, then go right. Move the seats around, go move the speakers around, but understanding what's actually going on with the sound waves around the room, and that's what I'm going to try to present today. I have a little PowerPoint presentation that's actually an excerpt of what I teach at CEDIA conferences and have been doing for about 20 years now. And I hope it'll help visualize what's going on in this crazy acoustic problem and help people figure out where to put their speakers, subwoofers, and seats.
Fantastic. And I want to make sure everybody understands. I know a lot of people listen to this show in their car, maybe while they're commuting or whatever. But if you have a chance to watch the video of this particular one, it's going to be really good because, like last week, and check out last week's as well, episode 177, because there's a lot of very good diagrams and graphics on the screen in the video portion of this podcast that really explain things very well. And I'm sure we'll see much the same today. So, Anthony Grimani, take it away.
Take it away. All right. Hey, John, we're going to switch over to the... there you go. This is a little excerpt of a PowerPoint presentation. It's actually a full-day class on how to do the design of a listening room or a home cinema, and this is specifically the portion on seating placement. We're going to start with that, and depending on how much time we have, we'll switch into more fundamental acoustic theory. But there's a few things you need to worry about from a sound point of view. First of all, is don't sit at standing wave peaks or dips. What the hell that means is that the sound in a room at the low frequencies, there's certain waves that are going to go back and forth between the front and back wall, left and right wall, ceiling and floor. And at some places, those waves are going to end up with a giant crest of sound, crest of sound pressure. And at other places, usually the one where you're going to put your seat, there'll be a hole, an actual cancellation of sound energy in the critical region of sound, which is typically 50 or 60 hertz, it's called. That's where most of the meat, most of the rumble, most of the energy in a film soundtrack resides. It's also where the fundamental of a kick drum resides. So your rock band could end up sounding like Tinker Toy, and your action movie could end up sounding like it's a 1930s horror show on the AM radio. So no good.
Oh,
don't
man.
Sit there.
I'm
going to show you, you know, how to avoid that. So first of all, here's a bunch of funny little squiggle lines. Those of you listening in the car, well, forget it. But what I'm showing here, I'm going to use my mouse here to point things out. What I'm showing here is a room, let's just say this is shown from front to back of the room. This is the back wall, the one behind you. Now, this would be the front wall, the one in front of you. And this little wing shape over here represents the sound level in the bass region at a certain frequency.
And that particular frequency where that dip is depends upon that dimension of...
Oh, we lost Scott. I guess I'll take it from here.
Okay.
I see where Scott's going. Scott was saying is it depends on the particular dimension of a room. Absolutely. If this is 22 feet from here to there, that hole will be somewhere around 25 hertz. If the distance from here to here is 30 feet, the hole is going to be at a lower frequency. So what this shows us first is right in the middle of the room, there's going to be a cancellation at a certain frequency, somewhere around 25 hertz. Not a big problem because there's not a lot of energy here. Let's go to the next picture over here on the right. Front wall, back wall. There'll be a cancellation of sound a quarter of the way in from the back wall and then three quarters of the way in from the back wall. And that would be around 50 hertz or 60 hertz, somewhere in the really important frequency region for a film soundtrack or music. And that says you don't want to sit here. You don't want to sit a quarter of the way into the room or three quarters of the way into the room. Pretty sure you're not going to sit three quarters of the way into the room because you'd be right up against your screen. But it's not uncommon to sit back here a quarter of the way into the room. Let's go down to this graphic down here. This actually shows another set of frequencies where you're going to have a problem. And this over here is 1/8 of the room. The peak would be at 2/8, which is 1/4. The null, so 1/8. I'm sorry, this is the 6th. Boy, I can't read from here. Maybe I should look at my computer. This is 1/6. This is 2/6. This is 3/6. That's 1/2. This is telling us, hey, maybe a good place to sit is not here at 1/6. Maybe not here at 2/6, which is 1/3. But maybe right between the two. That'd be okay because you're neither at a peak or a crest of sound. Here's another set of squiggly lines that show frequency that would be problematic, and this actually just ends up being four times the first frequency of resonance. And this is 1/8, 2/8, 3/8, 4/8. This says you don't want to sit 3/8 of the way back into the room. Maybe a seat position over here or over here would be okay. So all of this leads to a simplified solution, which I'm realizing here, unfortunately, through our videos, not looking quite right. But this is actually showing a top view of a room and an elevation view of a room. And these dots all represent places you can sit where the sound won't suck because of standing waves. Worst place actually would be half the way back in the room in the middle of the room. But if you can move back a little bit to 0.55 of the length of the room. So from front wall to seating position, 0.55 would not be bad. Another one over here, it's hard to see it. What this was actually trying to show in these gradients that actually got collapsed, unfortunately, in the video card, I think, is that a position about 0.68 of the way back in the room is a good one. Another one is 0.8 back in the room. So all of this complicated math and wave theory and pressure gradients and standing waves and all this stuff leads to some simple recipes. Simple recipe is try to sit either 0.55 of the way back in the room or 0.68 of the way back in the room from the front wall or 0.8 of the way back. If you follow those, you'll end up your chances are you'll end up not sitting in a peak or a dip of the standing wave. Same thing applies from the left to the right of the room. Now, you have a broader range of seating positions on the left and right, so I'm going to read out the numbers over here. There's a 0.2 that's a good position all the way back. 0.32 is a good one, 0.45, 0.55, 0.68, and 0.8. All right. Now, chances are that Murphy may be watching while they're trying to do this, and Murphy will place some interference at one of those locations. You may find, well, I can't sit here because there's a door, or I can't sit here because there's a potted plant. Well, at least you got some numbers. Again, 0.2, 0.32, 0.45, 0.55, 0.68, and 0.8 are all decent places to sit on the left, right of the room or front back of the room. Scott, are you back?
Hello, Scott.
Hello, Scott.
Sorry. Oh? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I dropped Skype, but you brought me back, and it sounded like Anthony was just sort of seamlessly moving along there.
Pretty much.
The show must go on, man.
Sorry. I was just going to ask. So it looks like the same ratios or the same percentages or fractions of the width of the room and the length of the room apply in both cases.
Absolutely. It's all about the length and width dimensions of the room. And we're also hoping, by the way, and I'll talk about this a little later, we're hoping that standing wave sound resonances don't end up being at the same frequencies along the length of the room and the width of the room and the height in the room, because that makes things even worse.
Right. And as you pointed out last week, that is the absolute worst case scenario for what you just said is a cubically shaped room.
Indeed. It's the worst case if you can't control it. Believe it or not, there's a few people, there's notably one good studio designer in England I know who designs rooms in a cubic way so as to actually make it the worst, but only the worst at three or four exact frequencies, and then you can trap it out. You can actually build these devices called bass traps that are large tube resonators or enclosures with a little port on them that allow to get rid of those frequencies. But that stuff you can't do in a living room. You can do that in a studio where it's a dedicated space. I don't recommend trying that at home.
Right. Okay. Moving right along.
Placing your seats in a room, of course, the first thing in thinking about where to place them is to avoid sitting at places where you have bad standing waves.
Right.
That's the first step. That's not the only thing. There's a whole bunch of other things you got to consider, and I'm going to go switch to those. Second thing is to make sure you have decent sight lines. You got to make sure that if you have multiple rows of seats, everybody can look over everybody else's head. And this typically does not work. If you've got, if you're lucky to have a home cinema where you have two or three rows, you can't just put everybody on the same row, because what's going to happen is, of course, as you can see here, the viewer on the back with a red hat and a director's chair is going to be looking over at the screen, and this person in front is going to cut out their view. So what you could try doing is raise the screen up, and all that's going to result in is this person's going to end up with a neck ache that's going to require chiropractic visits.
I was going to say, I absolutely do not recommend that. Everyone asks me, can I put my flat screen over the fireplace? And I say, absolutely not.
Yeah, you got to put it in the fireplace, and then you got to have like a little video of flames in there, and then everything works. It's fine.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, so the real solution in a real home cinema, home theater, if you're going to have more than a row of seating, is to do the usual tiered seating. Now, tiered seating, a lot of people go, well, you know, that's for movie theaters. Why do they do that? Well, they do that so everybody can have sight lines. If you're going to do a home cinema where you have two or three rows, consider raising the back row somehow, and or... at times, you can even do a little bit of construction and lower the front row. We're working on a project right now where we went into a decent-sized family room and just cut out the joists right here, created a pit, lowered the front row by about 12 inches, and this height that you see here in blue that in this image shows a raised floor is actually the main floor of the house. Mm-hmm. This height is a lowered height, and it was fine. There's plenty of room in the crawl space below the joist to do that.
They actually did that at the Chinese theater in Hollywood, which is now, it used to, originally was called the Grauman's Chinese, and then
Man's Chinese,
and now it's the TCL Chinese. The naming rights were bought by this Chinese giant company called TCL, and they turned it into an IMAX, and they actually had to excavate the front part of the seating area to drop it down in order to make stadium seating so that everyone had good sight lines to the IMAX screen.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of work over there.
A little more work than most.
Work. And what we're talking about is a solution for people who are trying to put together either a dedicated or semi-dedicated room or a family room in which you may have different heights of couches and seats so that everybody can see clearly over the heights, the heads above. If you're going to put a riser, by the way, make sure you have decent headroom. Sometimes I see people put 18-inch risers and then you end up with 6 or 6.5 or 7 feet of headroom, and that's just uncomfortable.
No kidding.
Interesting note is that if you're going to build a riser into a room, realize that this riser, which may be built out of regular framing and wood, could be built into a bass absorber. It's a volume. It's an enclosure that, if you constructed it the right way, perforated it the right way, could actually take care of your standing waves. By the way.
Amin Ra in the chat room is saying, geez, this stuff only applies to rich people. They're talking about rows. Now, it's true that in many very high-end home theaters, you do see these rows and risers, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's only applicable to the very wealthy, right?
I would agree. I mean, building a little riser at the back of a family room is a matter of a day-long project. You got to, you know, maybe you put some carpet on it or whatever. And a lot of times, even 6 or 8 inches is all it takes to get up high enough that you have decent sight lines. And you can't tell me that that's expensive. Yes, if you have a room that's large enough to be able to have two rows of seating for your home cinema that has a screen that's in excess of 80 or 90 inches, you're probably not making minimum wage. Or if you are making minimum wage, you're putting all of your money into your home cinema, which is what you should do, since that's the only thing that matters really out there.
Of course. Midnight Rider is asking, what about staggering the front and rear seats? You know, offsetting them horizontally.
Yeah, you can try that. If you have a relatively small screen, that'll work. You may be able to look through
the two heads in front of you. Yeah.
Yeah. If you have a good sized screen, they're going to block your view of the screen no matter what you try to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, you'd have to think about that the acoustic considerations that you were talking about earlier, about if you stagger the seats, you still want them to be in good locations for not being in the middle of a peak or a null in the standing waves, and staggering them for sight lines, you might not be able to achieve that as well.
Correct. So now you have two things you have to figure out at the same time. You have this standing wave thing, which is ensuring decent bass at all the seats, and now you have to come up with a riser height that puts people at the right heights for both sight lines and standing waves. So now you're starting to look at a science project where you have two variables. Actually, one of those things, remember, is simultaneous equations where you had two things you had to solve at the same time. Oh my God. Oh, my God. Now, I do have to mention that there's an interesting solution also out there, which is to have two rows of seats. If you don't want to do the riser business, you can have two rows of seats where the front row is a really low seating, like a low couch. And the back row is one of those raised stools, one of those raised bar stools that you select for being really comfortable. There's some really nice overstuffed models out there that have footrest, have armrests, and you could put that back there for the back row. And typically, the differences in height are about 12 to 13 inches between what your head or your eye location or head location would be on the front row of a low couch versus the tall, comfortable bar stools behind you.
That's a good idea. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Okay, good.
Sure, yep. Next thing in the process of figuring out where to put your seats is, after you've figured out that you have decent sound lines, is you gotta place your seats relative to the speakers or your speakers relative to your seats so that everything works out. So if your speakers can be moved, then the relationship and the choices are different. But ultimately, the angle formed by your head and a triangle between the left and right speakers should be around 45 degrees. So that's called a subtended angle. Left speaker's here, your head's over here, right speaker's over here. This is a view from the top. Ideally, those two speakers would be far away enough from each other to form a 45-degree angle. Mm-hmm. If they're much closer to each other, the soundstage collapses. You can't really hear separation between what's going on in the center and the left and rights. If a car is moving from right to left in the screen, you won't get the full spread of it. And by the same token, moving them further away could cause actually a loss of phantom images. So you may end up with holes in the soundstage between the left, the center, and the right. Somewhere around 45 degrees is what works well. Mm-hmm. So if those speaker locations are set for whatever reason, you know, design factor, divorce factor, couple comforts factor, whatever it is, you may need to figure out your location of seating here between front and back so that you get 45 degrees. While at the same time worrying about the standing wave. Of course, if Murphy's at work, where you get 45 degrees out of your speakers is also where you're in a giant hole at 60 hertz. Again, just wait a bit, move the seating position, try moving the speakers, try to do something so you get there.
Right. I was gonna say the seating position directly in the middle of the room. If you've put the screen in the middle of the wall and you want to be dead center to the screen, you're going to be in the middle of the room. You've got to offset that a little bit to get to the 0.45 or the 0.55, right?
Absolutely. You by bad luck, you could end up with a standing wave null from between the left and right of the wall. And, you know, I would say initial standard consideration, once you put you in the middle of the speakers, well, if you're there, you may actually be missing some bass. So you move yourself a little bit to the right or to the left, or move... you could try moving your speakers along with you, but realize also that in every surround decoder built since 1995, there is actually a sound delay function. In the old ones, you actually would set that in milliseconds, knowing that sound travels at 1.13 feet per millisecond, and you look at all the distances, and you do some more math with a simultaneous equation, and you talk backwards using deltas and sigmas, and you end up with the milliseconds. But good news is since about easily 98 to 2000, most surround processors ask you to tell you what is the distance between your main seat and your left speaker, your center speaker, your right speaker. And from that, the thing does the computations inside its little DSP brain and will actually delay speakers to put you back in the middle of the soundstage. So if you moved to the right enough that that you're closer to the right speaker by, let's say, a foot, you would tell it, hey, my speaker over here is 11 feet from me, the one on the left is 12 feet away from me. It will add a millisecond of delay, or 1.13 milliseconds of delay, and compensate it to the point where you're sitting off axis, the whole soundstage is twisted over, so it sounds great where you are. So don't worry about that part. As long as you go into the surround processor's menu and go to the place where it may say speaker distances or setup speaker system. Mm-hmm, go to manual mode. Sometimes they try to do that automatically with a little microphone that tries to figure it all out for you. Often doesn't quite work out right. Just take your tape measure, measure to the speaker, enter the dimensions using your little remote control, and it'll fix that for you.
Yeah. Aaron B. in the chat room wants to make sure that we make it clear that we're talking about those of us who have a dedicated home theater room and not a living room with a TV in it.
Some of these things, you know, the speaker position doesn't have to do with one or the other room. You should, even in a mixed use environment, you should actually try to place those speakers at the right location. Sorry, I'm distracted trying to look at my PowerPoint presentation, look at the camera, look at my watch, and all of that at the same time.
Quite all right.
So, dedicated room, absolutely. You've put the money out to have your own space. You want to make sure you're precise about the speaker positions and the time delays and all of that. But I would say even in a mixed-use room, all of those things matter. Position of the couch can actually radically change the bass perception and the soundstage perception of the speakers. Chances are you may not be able to move the couch. Or you may have to negotiate. You may have to take somebody out to dinner, or, you know, cook a really nice dinner for somebody. And maybe you can move the couch a bit or whatever. But just be aware and conscious that it is possible, if Murphy's at work, that wherever you've put your seat, you actually have a giant hole at 60 hertz because of sound resonances going back and forth in the room this way or back and forth laterally in the room. And, you know, the key to good life is consciousness, young man.
Very good. Grasshopper. Very good. We're talking Zen philosophy here.
We're Zenning here.
Very good. Quick question. iPad 81168 says, that's interesting. Dolby recommends 20 or 30 degrees angle for the right and left speakers. Now I'm confused. I think what he's talking about is probably the angle from the center line to each of those speakers.
That is correct. When Dolby says 30 degrees, they're talking about the axis. Now I'm out of that slide, so you'll have to forgive me. But they're talking about the axis between directly in front of you and the right speaker or the left speaker. So when they're saying 25, the pair of them would give you 50. It's really 22 and a half to give you 45. Now, right. Sometimes 50 works better. Sometimes 48 works better. That's just sort of generally in the guideline between 45 and 50 is a sure. is a good midpoint.
Right. Midnight Rider asks, should the speakers be towed in, that is, angled and pointed at the center or at the money seat, if we will?
That's a great question. Absolutely. There's very few speakers, actually, that have a wide enough dispersion at the upper mids and the higher frequencies to allow the left speaker, so I'm going in your direction, right? This is the left for you. The
yes,
left
correct.
Speaker to actually cover the right seat at the higher frequencies if it's pointing straight back. I recommend
right.
towing them in. You could tow them in as much as 22 degrees because that would make them point right at the middle of the room. Sometimes just towing them in 10 degrees is all it takes. How much do you know? Well, there's a really simple test. So there's a test signal called Pink Noise. It's my favorite band, by the way, Pink Noise, that you can get from many different test discs. You can download it off the internet. You can actually get little signal generators for your iPhone or your Android phone, and you can play that into the channel that feeds the left speaker, and you can just play it out of the left speaker. And then what you do is you walk back and forth or sit back and forth across the couch and listen in the middle, listen over on the right, listen on the left, and make sure that listen on the left, listen on the right. It's all backwards. And make sure that this overall spectrum, the overall quality of the sound is identical all the way around. That means everybody's getting the same sound.
Right.
And then you can try towing the speaker in and out a little bit and figure out where it starts to drop off. It's pretty significant. You'll hear it with most speakers.
Yeah, okay. Well, then let's get back to your presentation.
All right. Hold on 1 second. I'm still struggling trying to get it back where I want it.
Oh.
So,
oh.
Hey, Scott, fill some time. Fill some time.
Oh, I will fill some time. Very good.
Okay.
let's see. Kasi Will asks, does having a peaked or angled ceiling come into consideration? And the answer I would think is yes. Anthony would be better able to answer that question about exactly how, but he's busy.
Hold on. Let me readjust my comfortable pillow over here. All right. So a peaked ceiling is actually not so much going to change where you're putting your front speakers or your subwoofers. It's going to change the standing wave character, and it's also going to add a fair amount of reverberation into the room. So what do you do with that? Well, one thing you do is to make sure you have some kind of sound-absorbing material up on that peaked roof, which is either purpose-made panels or other soft materials you put up there. Another thing you can do is actually pick a loudspeaker that has a certain amount of focus in its dispersion. And there's different types of speakers made by different manufacturers with more or less vertical focus.
True. We were talking about this, I think, a bit last week in that line arrays, that is, vertical arrays of small drivers, do not disperse vertically nearly as much as sort of more conventional point source speakers. And so that would be one way to solve that problem.
Yeah, that's right, Scott. A line array is a good design to use if a room has a very tall ceiling or a peaked ceiling, because it just won't light up the ceiling so much, and you'll get good clarity of the dialogue and all the sound effects and good separation between the different sounds.
Mm-hmm.
There's also speakers. I actually have this somewhere in my presentation, but I won't lose where I'm at since I finally found where I have to be.
good.
But if you look at a speaker that's made out of a woofer, a a horn loaded tweeter in the middle and another woofer below, and you stand that thing vertically, that's a speaker that naturally is going to focus energy at you and away from the ceiling and floor. Excuse me. And that's a good design to use for a room with a tall ceiling or a peaked ceiling if you don't want to do some kind of control of the sound reflections up there.
Gotcha.
Okay, so I've got more stuff here, more slide presentations.
Again, yes, please.
This is an excerpt from a Cedia class. I don't know if you guys know who Cedia is, but Cedia is a good friend of mine. It's actually a trade association. Stands for Custom Electronics Design and Installation Association, and right. it's a group of ultra geeks who spend their life selling and installing home theaters and other audio video systems. And once a year, everybody gets together at some city somewhere, descends upon the poor inhabitants of that city, and all 30,000 people all trade information and show each other their equipment. If I show you mine, I'll show you yours and all of that.
Right.
And one of the things that happens over there is a lot of education, and I teach some classes on all of this stuff. So,
right. And in fact, we just came from the Cedia Expo 2 weeks ago or so. So it happens every September. And you were teaching there this year, as in years past. And we get the benefit of seeing something of your course, what you taught there.
Correct. So while we were talking, I actually got messed up and got to the place where we talk about speaker directivity. So why not?
Which is just what we were talking about.
You never know. Accidents are beautiful.
Indeed.
So I have a topic in here in my presentation. It's called "What's All This About Directivity?" Interesting thing is, in the pro audio business, there's a lot of talk about directivity, how a speaker sends sound into a room. And in the home audio business, nobody ever talks about it. And it's a real pity, especially when it comes to surround sound audio. So
right, which is actually turns out to be a perfect segue with Wirt's comment in the chat room, or question, which is, what makes a studio speaker different from home theater?
That's a good question. Sometimes absolutely nothing, other than it's a gray. It's sold in the studio business, and sometimes a lot. So let me cover this, and let me tell you about what some studio speakers are like. So,
sure.
What's all this about directivity? A normal speaker is made out of cones and domes. They usually have what's called flat axial response. What that means is that the sound that's going from the speaker to the listening position has a smooth sound character, which is that it doesn't emphasize any particular frequencies. And it's a speaker in which the way it spreads sound in the room depends a bit on frequency. So a real loudspeaker will do this. At low frequency, it'll radiate all the way around it. It's sort of like a hemisphere of sound. I'm showing here a typical example of 100 hertz radiation. In the mid-frequencies, it tends to focus more hemispherically, so forward into the room. It's still lighting up laterally, like if there's left and right walls around you, typically there are in rooms, it'll light up those walls with sound. And then at high frequency, they tend to beam forward. Excuse me.
Mm.
That's a typical two-, three-way hi-fi speaker. That's how they're built. That's how they've always been done. Now, there are ways to get more directivity than that, and some speakers have more focus than others. They can do it by either stacks of drivers, like you mentioned, Scott, the typical line array or line source. They can do it with using horns, which is a bell-shaped device in front of the mid-ranges and tweeters, and sometimes they do it using tall stacks of ribbon drivers. So this is sort of the obvious pro audio speaker that you'll see actually often used by a band in a concert. It's a two-way horn-loaded speaker. It may have a big woofer, like a 12 or 15-inch woofer, and a big horn on top. They often sound positively horrible when they're sold into the public address business because cost is a real issue. And durability is a real issue. They're made out of plastic. You got to be able to bang them around on a tour. Sound quality isn't necessarily the point. However, there is a way to design a speaker like this to sound absolutely glorious. And there's a few manufacturers out there that focus on that. Notably, can I mention brands?
Yes, absolutely. Please do. I was about to ask.
So JBL, for example, you know, who's been in business for, you know, more than what?
60 years?
60 or
yeah.
70 years.
Yeah.
has several lines of high-end audiophile speakers with horn loading, and they sell them really, really well in Asia and Europe. Americans tend to be predisposed to see a horn and go, oh my God, it's going to sound like a duck. But they've introduced some new speakers recently that are horn loaded that sound absolutely audiophile. Fantastic. And you can put them on a blind AB comparison, where somebody does this, what are you listening to, a duck or a speaker? And you can listen to, a reputable high-end hi-fi speaker or audiophile speaker at, multi-ten-thousands of dollars and switch over to this horn-loaded thing that you would have a preconceived notion would sound bad. And it sounds every bit as good, if not better. So there is a way to make a horn-loaded speaker sound fantastic. So don't immediately say, I can't do that.
Don't dismiss them out of hand.
Don't dismiss it. A yet better way to get directivity is to do a stack like this, where you actually are combining the concept of stacks of drivers with horns. So you may have two woofers with a horn in the middle. What that does is it provides directivity to a lower frequency, because those two woofers will create a beaming in the vertical direction. Another way to do the directivity, and this is really not obvious to people, but there's a fair number of speakers that are built this way with two woofers, two mid-ranges, and a tweeter in the middle. Lots of companies do that, and they may do it to get more sound level out of their speakers because there's more drivers, so they things play louder. But realize this kind of construction is going to create more focus towards the listening position, because these two woofers are going to create a beaming of sound vertically towards the listener. The two mid-ranges are going to create a beaming of sound in the critical mid-range, and the tweeter in the middle is going to straddle all of that and give you a nice high-frequency dispersion. So this is not so obvious as a way to get control of sound directivity in a room, especially one with a tall ceiling. And then this is what Scott was talking about before, which is the line array, which may be a stack of tweeters, mid-ranges, and woofers, or just tweeters and bass mid-ranges. It's a bunch of different ways to do those.
Mm-hmm. My question regarding the second set of speakers there, the one with the woofers on the outside, two mid-ranges inside of them and a tweeter in the middle. When you have matching drivers next to each other or separated by some distance and they're producing the same frequencies, doesn't that cause or provide the potential anyway for what's called comb filtering, interference between the sound waves coming from those individual drivers that are separated by some distance?
Well, that's a great question, Scott. And I actually have. yes. And I'm actually going to address that in a slide that's coming up in just a second. So let's put that in the parking lot. I will say.
Okay, we'll put that on the side.
On the side. I will say that a properly implemented design of this type will cross over those two woofers right before they start to create this ugly, actually clover leaf shape that could create problems. It's called lobing. And then they'll switch over to the mid-ranges so that the mid-ranges actually create this pattern with a bit of focus. And then just before they start to create this lobing that may actually put some holes of sound at certain places in the room, they cross over to the tweeter. And these speakers are a little bit more complicated to design and build. The actual internal electronics called a crossover takes more components and more design time and more parts and more weight, and they cost more. And in exchange for more money, you get better sound. Sometimes you do get what you pay for.
Sometimes you do.
Not always.
Well, before we go on, take a moment, take a little break there. Let me take a moment here to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Ting. Now, what is Ting, you ask? I will tell you. It is a no BS mobile phone service. It's a reseller of the nationwide Sprint network, as a matter of fact. And what makes Ting different is that there are no contracts or early termination fees. It's really contract free, and there's nothing to worry about. In fact, they have a new early termination fee relief program. If you're going to pay an ETF to come to Ting, they've got your back. Ting will give you a credit of 25% of your early termination fee, up to $75 per device. Simply purchase your device through Ting, port your number, then submit your final bill with your ETF detailed from your previous carrier. Go to ting.com/ETF for more information. You know, Ting charges no bundling, no ride-along services. You can choose from XS through XXL service levels for voice minutes, text messages, megabytes of data, all billed separately. And there are no overage charges or penalties. If you use more than you thought you would, you just pay for what you used. There's no add-on charges for voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, all that stuff are all part of the service. And there's no mysterious line items on your bill. Ting charges you for what you used, plus whatever taxes they're legally required to collect. But there are no hidden charges or recovery fees. And not only that, you have unlimited devices on one plan. You can have as many devices as you want on that single plan, sharing pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes. Each device on a plan costs a flat $6 per month. There's even a powerful online account control panel that lets you control your account, your usage, see your bill. And if you ever have any questions, there's a no-hold customer support. You call them at 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And a real person will pick up the phone. How rare is that? They have excellent online support as well. Just go to help.ting.com and you can access their active customer forums, simple and powerful help ticketing system, video tutorials, video startup guides, and much more. First, all you have to do is purchase your mobile device from Ting, which you will receive in 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device with Ting and have the option to select a new phone number or port an existing one. Ting will break your rates out by minutes, text messages, and megabytes and bill you at the end of the month for what you've used. Visit Ting today at htg.ting.com and save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Home Theater Geeks viewers also save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit htg.ting.com and start saving today. So, Anthony, you were about to continue on with your most excellent and informative presentation.
To go switch to Ting, I got to get out of my contract because it's painful.
Well, obviously, there are some really good reasons to think about Ting for sure.
Thank you, Ting. I'll certainly look into it myself. And that was a completely benevolent and real heartfelt endorsement, I guess.
There you go. Fantastic.
Ting. All right. So speaker directivity. It's kind of interesting. We got into this conversation as a little, essentially a digression from where to place speakers. But, you know, the reality is, in a way, I'm almost happy you brought this up because figuring out where to play speakers without having the right speakers is really impossible. So you do have to start with the right speaker for your room. So all this about speaker directivity is ultimately, given the choice, you want to match the directivity of your speaker to your room and your intended usage. Otherwise, no amount of futzing and tinkering and tinging will ever get you to hear the speaker right. So, for example, a regular 2 or 3-way wide dispersion speaker in a room that's really big, like a big family room with no treatment, it's not going to sound good. Whereas a speaker with some directivity may cut through all of that reverb and all that echo and give you a better presentation for just maybe a slightly increased price. So remember that a higher directivity in the speaker, so, you know, horns, stacks of drivers, whatever, higher directivity is going to give you better clarity and tighter imaging. And then a lower directivity, so more dispersion in the room, is going to give you smoother quality and more envelopment. So that's important, too. High directivity isn't right for all rooms. If you have a small room, if you have a room that's only 16 feet long and you got a fair amount of absorptive surfaces around because you have carpeting, you have drapes, maybe even bought some Dimension 4 acoustical treatments from us or something. If you had a speaker that focused a lot of sound at you, it would sound like a giant headphone, and you don't want that. You really do want to match the directivity of the speaker to the room. So somebody asked, you know, what's the difference between a pro speaker and a home speaker? Well, there are some manufacturers of professional of speakers for use in professional studios that have just wide directivity speakers. They're a 6.5 or 8-inch woofer with a tweeter in a flat baffle. They cover just the same way, and they have just the same sound as a hi-fi speaker. Typically, these days, they have a power amp built in. And really, in terms of sound performance, it's not going to be any different to a hi-fi speaker.
Somebody in the chat room actually asked that question. Could I use a professional studio monitor as my home theater speaker? And I think what you're saying is yes, under certain circumstances.
Yes, under certain circumstances. So that is, you know, understanding what its limitations are or are not. You know, it doesn't know that it's sending sound to a professional listener or a consumer. It doesn't care. It gets sound in one side or signal in, and it puts out sound pressure on the other side, and it can work fine. There are some studio monitors with specific pattern in their dispersion. Those are sort of the ones that may be mounted up on the soffit over the console, and they're made to beam sound at the mixer's ears and away from the recording console. In a recording studio, you have this large console, this large table, maybe 4 feet, 5 feet long, with all these little knobs all over that form a sound reflection if you don't control it. And
good point.
The makers of the kinds of speakers that would be mounted up in this soffit, I'm trying to use mounted up there.
Yes.
Would actually want to beam the sound towards the listener. And that may or may not work right for you in a home cinema environment.
Right, right. Okay, well, let's get back to the subject of speaker placement. And I want to make sure we leave enough time for subwoofer placement, which is very, very important.
Exactly. So I'm gonna get out of this business of directivity and go forward to this speaker placement business. So I finally found my way back to where I wanted to be. We'll ignore all this mess. Okay. So let's recap a little bit. Speaker placement considerations. You want to, in a home cinema, of course, in the placement of the speaker, there's one more element you got to consider, which is the relationship to the picture. You want to make sure the speaker is placed correctly relative to where your picture is. You want to worry about the interface between the boundaries, the reflective surfaces around the speaker and your listening condition. You want to worry about standing waves. We've talked about those. You want to worry about that placement width, the 45 degree. And here's one more thing you got to think about is the speaker should be as close as possible to seated ear height.
So now, obviously, a speaker is a tall thing, typically. Seated ear height would be corresponding to one of the drivers. I've always thought it should be corresponding to the tweeter.
Yeah. Wow, it gets complicated. So first of all, one thing is, remember that when you're deciding where to put these speakers, there's five things you have to consider at the same time. You know, you have to put that equation simultaneously in your head and make sure you scramble it the right way. At this point, you may actually need to drink a little wine or something to appease your anxiety. but yeah, what is the actual right height for a speaker? Is it the tweeter? Or is it halfway between the tweeter and the mid-range? Is it below the mid-range? Well, some manufacturers actually design the speaker so that you're listening below the tweeter. You may actually notice there's some speakers where the tweeter's below the mid-range woofer.
Okay.
So this gets complicated.
Right.
First thing is, if it's a tower speaker, plump it down. They probably have designed it so that when you're sitting in your couch with your seated ear height somewhere between 38 and 40 inches, which is, you know, typically where it ends up, all comes out fine. If you want to get more technical than that, go back to our friend Pink Noise. Play Pink Noise into that speaker and listen, going up and down and up. Whoop, I can't hear it anymore. And down. And make sure that where you're sitting, you actually hear all the sound waves correctly. When you do this up and down business, you may actually start hearing gaps in the sound between the tweeter and the mid-range or the tweeter and the woofer. And, of course, you don't want to be sitting at that height.
Right. Okay, excellent. It is more complicated than just put the tweeter at ear height.
Indeed. So let's see. I guess I'm kind of going backwards, realizing that the position of a speaker will affect its sound. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Now, you can do some amount of computer modeling if you're an acoustical engineer. If you hire an acoustical engineer, they can actually figure this out from looking at the dispersion character of the speaker. You can measure it with an analyzer. You can go get a good test microphone and an analyzer and play around with that. Or, hey, you can use your ears and listen to Pink Noise. Now, That business of the speaker height, let's say because of your whole arrangement in the room, you end up with a seating height that's actually lower than where the speaker ends up. And the speaker has ended up at a height so that it matches the screen, but now it's firing over your head. Well,
right.
Aim it down, duh. As long as you can.
Sort of like towing in, but in the perpendicular direction.
Exactly. So you definitely want to tow in the speaker and then aim it up or down so that you're in the middle of the seating position. So now let's look at this business of where you put the speakers relative to a screen. Typical screen placement, if you're using a flat screen or a hard screen, something that doesn't let sound through it, is to put the left and right speakers to the left and right edges of the screen, with the height of these speakers being close to seated ear height. The left and rights here should be about 40 inches. The axis of listening of those speakers should be around 40 inches. Mm-hmm. Now, what about the center speaker?
And well, in fact, we got a question in the chat room. Midnight Rider asks, is it better to place the center channel above or below?
Good question. Well, it depends on circumstances. I usually like it below because it just sort of it inherently sounds more realistic, although usually the head of most actors is going to be about 5/8 to 3/4 of the way up the screen. If you look at how a picture is composed, if you look at how we're all set up on screen. So you may want to put it above, but I usually find it sounds more natural and integrates better with the left and right speakers. There's a little guideline I've put here that says don't offset the height by more than 2 feet between the left, right, and center speaker. And that's so that the image that's formed across the frontal soundstage has a chance of holding together.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when you put the speaker above the screen, the match of the sound of the center to the screen may be better, but it starts to mismatch the left and right speakers. So as a sound goes across from left to right of the screen, it falls apart.
Good point. Good idea. I hadn't thought of that.
So of course the preferred solution is the sort of the pinnacle of it all, which is to use an acoustically transparent screen. That of course means you can't use a flat screen TV, no LCD, no plasma, no OLED, none of that stuff. But you actually have, yes, a projector.
Right.
Now, projectors used to cost a lot of money. Projectors that put out a lot of light used to cost even more money. The good news is that the prices have really changed a lot these days, and you can get them for not a huge amount of money. And you can get something that puts out 2,000 or 3,000 lumens that's going to light up a 90 to 100-inch screen quite nicely, even with ambient light, for very reasonable amounts. So,
and by that we're talking about $2,000 to $3,000?
$2,000 to $3,000 will buy you a projector that puts out ungodly amounts of light these days with a pretty good picture, mm-hmm. and would allow you to go get an acoustically transparent screen from one of the 5 or 6 manufacturers that make them now,
yep.
and allow you to put that center speaker where it should be so that the sound actually comes from the person's mouth. Here, not
right.
here, not here, not here, but here, imagine that. Now,
imagine that. Plus, it puts the center speaker at the same height as the left and right,
correct.
which solves the sound field problem.
Correct. It gets it off the floor. So when you have a speaker low under a screen, it is closer to the floor. Its sound bounces off the floor and creates interference between the direct sound and the reflected sound. So the quality goes down. By raising it up and putting it right where it should be, it sounds more better. It matches the left and rights. The sound image and the picture image all work better in your brain. The overall experience is much more cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly, what's an acoustically transparent screen? There's two ways to make them. My preferred way is a woven microfiber. Usually it's fibers of fiberglass or some other synthetic material covered in vinyl, which vinyl has a white character to it that's actually true white. And there's different weaves, different manufacturers. You can get them rolled down, fixed, all kinds of different ways. But that's my preferred way. Another way is to take a traditional sheet of vinyl screen and micro perforated with lots and lots of little holes close together. There's other manufacturers who prefer that approach. Either way, doing that will improve your sound over having the center speaker below or above the screen.
Got it. Let's take a moment to talk about surround speaker placement, and then I really don't want to lose the opportunity to talk about subwoofer placement.
All right. Actually, there's one little thing I realized in this presentation I want to make sure we don't forget.
Okay.
And this is a huge pet peeve of mine. You may notice that a lot of manufacturers make a center loudspeaker that looks kind of like this, seen from above. So it has, this is sort of an angled view, but it has two woofers and a tweeter in the middle.
Right. A lot of manufacturers make that kind of speaker, center channel speaker.
Right. The majority of them are built this way. You mentioned earlier, Scott, that, hey, isn't that going to create some kind of funny interferences? And yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Without getting into a lecture on wave theory and speaker design and all this fun stuff that I just love to do, I will just say that in the critical 2 kilohertz range, which is right in the middle of where intelligibility is at its peak.
It's a speech intelligibility you're talking about.
Speech intelligibility, not intelligibility of mathematics. But
yes. being able to understand what someone's saying.
All y'all, you're hearing me here. So right at 2 kilohertz, which is the frequency that if you could actually notch it out with an equalizer, you would notice you hear people speaking, but it sounds all weird, like you can't quite tell what they're saying. Right in that region, those horizontal center speakers that have two woofers and a tweeter in the middle create this lobing pattern. Lobing pattern mean that they send good sound directly in front of them, and then about 10-15 degrees off to the left or to the right, there's actually a hole of sound. And then you go further, then it comes back, and then there's another hole. So this little diagram on my PowerPoint shows that. And imagine that you're sitting right in front of the speaker, and you're like, wow, this sounds great, this movie, I understand everybody. And your partner, your significant other, male or female, is sitting one seat to the left or the right, and they're like, you know, can you turn it up? I don't get what they're saying. And then every time there's a music effect that's coming out of the other speakers, you're blown out of your seat. So, oh, can you turn it down? Can you turn it up? Can you turn it down? Can you just turn it off? So manufacturers of center speakers have been building them like this for 20 years, and they sound terrible to anybody who's not right in front of them. Mm-hmm. How can you tell that it's going to be one of those? Pink noise is, again, your friend. Put up some pink noise in the center channel. Playing from one of the test discs you can get. We have this thing called a TK51 we sell, but other people make some great ones. Play pink noise in the center channel. Listen right on axis. Move one seat to the left, one seat to the right, and just take a listen and notice if the sound's not changing, all is good. But if you move over to that one seat to either side and it just sounds like it's suddenly going, shoo, you got a problem. So that's a big pet peeve of mine. What do you do if you have one of those speakers?
What do you do if you have one of those speakers?
What do you do? Well, you can either chuck it, audio gone, and get something better. Or if you can, you can actually try to turn it vertically if there's room below the screen. You can actually turn it vertically and then remember to aim it up at your seating position. And or if you just bought it, bring it back and say, you know what, I want something different. This is not working for me. You may explain to them that it's got a lobing pattern because at 2 kilohertz you move off axis and 10 degrees here, and the guys at the store are going to look at you like,
what?
So you just say, you know what, I want something different. So and then in the store, bring your test disc with you and listen to the different speakers. So caveat emptor, I love to mm-hmm. say that. It's like I said, watch out what you're buying. There are speakers out there with two woofers and a tweeter in the middle with a special crossover design that's more expensive, in which they've found a way around that, which is they drop off one of the woofers above 200 or 300 hertz. The other one continues up to the tweeter crossover, and then you don't have this lobing problem. They cost more. It's more complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's talk about one other quick thing here, which is the effect of the boundaries on the loudspeakers. So I mentioned earlier that you need to watch out for that. Realize that your left speaker is going to send some sound towards you, and some of it's going to bounce off the left wall or bounce off the floor and ceiling. And that bounce, I think we talked about this last week, that bounce is going to create some interferences at your seating position. Actually, the interferences are very similar in physical effect to this thing we just talked about with the lobing. Now, on this diagram, I'm showing in green the ideal sound response of a good speaker, and that's how much level it puts out towards you in the room as a function of frequency. Mm-hmm. And in blue is what's going to happen after the sound has bounced off different boundaries around the room.
Which mostly means walls or sometimes screens.
Usually walls, floor, ceiling, and back wall.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a peak of sound from a constructive interference where the two waves actually crest at your head. Or there could be a dip of sound, which is where the two waves are out of phase. They actually are moving in opposite directions at your head, and you have a cancellation. You cannot compensate this through equalization. Impossible. And there's manufacturers of auto EQ systems that say, hey, they can fix all that. You can't. Once the sound waves have canceled each other out at your head because they're coming from two different directions at different times, there's nothing you can do in the equalization to fix this. The only thing you can do is try to maybe move the speaker around in the room so that the way it hits the wall and comes back to you is less of an interference. Or you can put some kind of absorption material on the lateral walls or the wall behind you, or maybe a really thick rug on the floor in front of you to fix or reduce that. How do you know you got a problem? Well, it's really easy to see if you have an analyzer. And these days, actually, if you're willing to spend $100, $150 on a little test microphone and a little USB adapter, and then you can download one of the measurement tools out there available from a few different people, you can actually measure this. You can see it, and you can play around with your speaker position and get rid of those peaks and dips naturally, not through through just electronic auto equalization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, gosh, we're almost out of time here, and we haven't gotten to the surround speakers or the subwoofers yet.
All right, let's talk about subwoofers. That's really, really
because that's really important. Let's spend the remainder of the time we have talking about subwoofers.
Scott, how much more time do we have before you boot me off this this fine show?
Well, our next show is due to start in about 13 minutes.
All right.
We need to give them time to set up and so on, so...
A few minutes. All right. Let me get to the subwoofer portion of this because this is actually kind of fun. And this actually is going to look scary, but the solutions are actually quite easy. So subwoofer good. Placement. So it's actually good to do a little planning and, if possible, some acoustical modeling ahead of time. There's some programs you can get out there to predict what's going to happen. Realize that in subwoofer placement, rule number one is there will be a clash between aesthetics and acoustics. Where the subwoofer placement is the best is where it's going to look the ugliest. Absolutely. Always. It is best to use multiple subwoofers in the room than one single subwoofer, and to use them in what's called mono, which is that they're all getting the same sound at the same time. And there's ways to place them in a room so as to eliminate a room mode, which is a technical term for a standing wave. So how right. do we do that? I prefer to have multiple small subwoofers rather than one big honker. Now, remember that in order to improve your bass, you can try to move the seats. You can try to use some bass absorption. We talked about this last week. Mm-hmm. If you can measure the frequency response or listen to a single tone sweep that's, again, available off test signals, you'll have some idea of how good or how bad your responses are. But realizing that by moving a subwoofer or a speaker in the room, you can actually drive the standing waves into a cancellation mode. How? Here's how. So here's an interesting little diagram. So about half an hour ago, I showed this example of a room where this would be the front and this would be the back of the room. Or actually, mm-hmm. you know what? Scratch that. Let's just say that this is the left and right of the room. And you're sitting right here. And at a certain frequency, based on the width of the room, there's a null. You're sitting right here in the middle and there's no sound. Well, an interesting little factoid is when there's a null, to the left of that null is one polarity of sound, and to the right of that null is the inverse polarity of sound. That's inherent with the construction of a standing wave. So when this is going up and down, that's going down and up in terms of sound pressure.
Right.
So what
they're out of phase with each other. In other
the
words.
Two pressures are out of phase. So who cares? By the same token, by the way, this diagram shows that what's called the first harmonic of the standing wave, which is actually where the wave is twice as long as the room. When the wave is the same length of the room, there's two harmonics where the pressure is plus, then minus, then plus. Mm-hmm. At the third harmonic, which is three times the frequency from the first harmonic, there are nulls at a sixth, 3/6, which is a half, and 5/6 of the room. And the pressure goes plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, et cetera, on up. So yep. Who cares? Why am I telling you this? Why am I telling you this? Well, guess what? When you put a subwoofer in the corner of a room, like a lot of people do, it's going to drive all the standing waves all in their most favored way. But And this is what you're going to get. You put a subwoofer in the front corner of the room. You're going to get a peak, a dip, a peak, a dip. And, oh, look at that. You happen to be sitting of the a quarter of the way into the room, and you got bad bass right here.
But right, remember, you can't even hear that frequency hardly
nothing,
at all.
It's gone. It's going to be 25 dB attenuated. It's gone. Now, remember that when the pressure is plus here, it's also negative here, and it's plus here. You don't hear that because you're sitting in a hole. But guess what? If you put a subwoofer right here to where it's pushing and pulling the plus and minus side at the same time, the contradiction you're going to do on that standing wave is going to reduce the standing wave effect. Because instead of having a seesaw of sound pressure, the thing is, the actual molecules of air are going to be forced to go in phase, and the standing wave will be diminutized, reducetized, eliminated.
Diminished.
So that's pretty cool. You can actually take the subwoofer, move it into the room a quarter of the way, and it will reduce the audibility of the standing wave where you are when you are three quarters of the way back in the room. Now, that could be ugly. That could be a subwoofer in the middle of the floor. What are you going to do with that? Well, check this out. If instead of moving it into the room, you put one in the front and one in the middle, two smaller ones, and you run them together, these are going to want to push the pressure waves together and pull them together and contradict the desire of the standing wave to go plus, minus, plus, minus.
Ah, so putting two subwoofers in the room, one at one end and one in the middle, does something of the same thing as putting the one subwoofer a quarter of the way.
Correct. So you can either move the subwoofer or put two smaller subwoofers in the room. Now, this goes on and on and on because here I'm only showing one standing wave condition, which is the second harmonic of the length. But what about the third? And what about the fourth? And what about the width, the height, and all this other stuff? Well, guess what, folks? There's two layouts of subwoofers that work really well without futzing with all this, and that is to use four smaller subwoofers placed either midpoints of the front, back, and left, right walls, or putting them in the four corners of the room. This is, these days, is my favorite solution. There's a guy called Todd Welty, a researcher in acoustics, that's figured out all the math behind this. It's fascinating. You can actually download and read his 25-page AES paper. It's actually the topic of a PhD thesis. So if you have any problems at all with insomnia, I guarantee this will cure it.
Now, Floyd Toole also came up with similar results, did he not? He's a researcher that worked at Harman for many years and did a lot of this acoustics and loudspeakers in rooms kind of research. And I believe he came up with a very similar solution.
So here's the deal. With all due respect to my friend Floyd Toole, he did not come up with this. It's his underling, Todd Welty, that did all this work under the direction of Floyd Toole. So, yes, Floyd's team came up with this. It's Todd Welty and a buddy of his that worked together with him, Alan Devantier, who did some of the seminal work on this and published some really fascinating papers on this. So if you were to choose to get rid of the big 18-inch subwoofer that your significant other that lives with you is tired of looking at because it's just ugly, and replaced it by four smaller 10-inch subwoofers that you can hide away in either
the
four corners of the room, you will, one, win points with a significant other, two, get better bass. And you may not actually have to cook a really nice dinner.
Wow. Well, right there is the gem. Unfortunately, we didn't get to talk about the subwoofer crawl, which is one way I've learned to find a good position for the subwoofer.
Let me talk about that 2 seconds.
Okay, go for it.
I am sorry to say, but it doesn't work very well. And it doesn't work very well specifically in the condition, if we can go back to my my little slide here. Now I'm stealing from the next people in terms of time. In the subwoofer crawl, by the way, if you happen to put the subwoofer right here, check it out. Yeah, if you happen to put it not here, but over here, right where you sit, you're going to cancel out the second harmonic standing wave in the room, and you're going to crawl around the room, and you won't actually hear that problem, which is typically the worst one, the 60 hertz problem in the room. So I've learned that the subwoofer crawl doesn't always work very well, and instead you got to actually try different placements of subwoofer in the room until you find one that works. Before I also go out of here, let me also mention that if you can only get two subwoofers in your budget or your interior design, a good placement for the two subwoofers is middle of left and right wall or middle of front and back wall. And that could actually be more palatable for both design and pocketbook and end up with much better bass. This is also work that Todd Welty did under direction of Floyd Toole, and it, I have tried it a number of times. It works very good.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Anthony Grimani of MSR Acoustics. We should also say that you, your company does make acoustic treatments that people can buy and put up in their rooms. You also offer acoustic consulting, and you can find out all about that at msracoustics.com.
Thank you.
Thanks
Scott.
So much, Anthony. Really appreciate you being here.
I had a good time. Thanks a lot, Scott. I look forward to coming back sometime soon and talk about more stuff.
More stuff.
There's
so much more to talk about, and I'm sure I would love to have you back, and we will certainly make sure that happens. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and also at avsforum. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek will really be Mike Heiss, an industry consultant. He was originally scheduled to be on this week, but I really wanted to get Anthony back on to talk about speaker placement and seating placement and more about acoustics, a part two, if you will. But next week, we'll be pre-recording, actually. Those of you who are watching live, I encourage you to tune in on Friday, this coming Friday, the 18th, at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time, when Mike Heiss and I will be talking about HDMI 2.0 and other topics related to the upcoming Ultra HD higher definition standard that is yet to be a full standard. Anyway, that should be very interesting. It'll be aired on next Monday when Mike and I and everybody that I know will be at the SMPTE Technical Symposium. So do join me on Friday if you can for that. Otherwise, check it out on Monday, and I look forward to seeing you then. Until then, as always, geek out.